All right. Let's get this started, I guess.
All right.
All right. Welcome to another episode of Bioluminescence. Tonight, I made an audible. Originally, the plan was for me to do this episode solo and go into some, you know, history of my career, pre-Pretty Lights, during Pretty Lights, so on and so forth. And a special thing happened today. Two of the most legendary individuals I have ever worked with just so happened to be in Atlanta at the same time. And so we're going to do a little roundtable regaling of road stories from the last, I don't know, 6 or 7 years, I guess.
Woo, right? It can get dangerous.
Yeah. So first off, let me introduce Nathan Smokey Williams. You may know him as the guy responsible for all the streams that we've done in the past. And he sets up all the video and makes sure that I don't look like an idiot.
And no one has ever referred to me as legendary. I guarantee it.
Well, great job, Smokey.
I consider you legendary.
Well, thanks. That's all that matters, right?
And if there was a word better than legendary, I can't come up with one right now, but use your imagination. Let me introduce you to the laser sniper.
Yeah.
Neil Nance.
Thank you, sir.
Hey, bud.
He's definitely above a legendary status. There is no harder working man in show business than Neil.
That's it. So these guys have both been on the road with me for the last, I don't know, 5, 6, 7, however many years it's been.
8, Greg.
Has it been that long?
Myself, yeah, 8.
Yeah.
2013, I think, was my first show with you.
So 7 years for you, yeah. 8. See that? Yeah. There you go.
It's flying.
These two gentlemen are very much responsible for just how great the Pretty Lights productions have been over the last 8 years. You know, I get a lot of credit for all the, you know, stuff you guys see, but it's really, you know, these two guys and the rest of our crew, you know, that make sure that this shit gets set up properly. And even more than that, like the day leading into the concert goes a certain way so that when the show actually starts, we don't feel overwhelmed. And I can say wholeheartedly that without these two guys, it probably wouldn't be what it has been. And I just want to thank you both for all your hard work. And we're going to have some fun. We're going to think about times gone by. We're going to have some laughs. And to get things rolling, I think we want to start with a very legendary evening. Also legendary. If you ask many a people, this was a very special night. Was this was it 2017 or was it 2016?
I want to say 2016.
Yeah. All right, so it was at the Bank of something.
New Hampshire.
The Bank of New Hampshire Pavilion in somewhere New Hampshire. By a lake. I can't remember where it was.
Is that New Brunfield?
No, that's Texas.
Guilford, New Hampshire?
Guilford, New Hampshire. There you go. There we go, guys. All right.
Best catering in the world.
Best catering in the world.
Probably one of the better... I would say it's probably my favorite venue to play.
Yeah. It's amazing. It's an amazing
place.
It's
built for the crew and the artists.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
There's a treehouse. There are games. There's a giant fire pit with s'mores. There's all sorts of magical things going on there. But,
That night. Yes.
So if you recall, 4 years ago, there was an Instagram post of a sign saying "No Totems" that I posted in response to the abundance of totems at that show. And for me personally, I've never really had a problem with them. I've always kind of found it amusing. You know, there are a lot of lighting designers out there that, you know, they need to see the stage and they don't want to be distracted. And for me, it's never really been that big of a deal. I think it's great, sort of. Until I realized that they were blocking our cameras for both the video wall and the live stream. And so Smokey, our video director, took it upon himself to make that sign. And I'm going to let you kind of take it from there.
I think when you're at front of house, you basically see through them. It's like a chain link fence. You don't see the totems when you're there.
That's a great analogy. I never thought about it that way, but totally right.
But being an onstage guy, the only view I have of my rig is through a camera. So I can see what's going on, see if there's problems or whatnot. And every fucking time, there's somebody with like a squid with lights on it or a big fucking sign that's just
jellyfish.
Right in the middle, right where I want to see.
Yep.
Exactly where I want to see. So I guess it was like 20, 30 minutes before we went on.
Well, okay, let's backtrack a little bit. Because the first night,
That was the first night.
That you made the sign the first night? Or was it the second night?
Yeah, I think it was the second night.
It might have been the second night.
Yeah, because we made it during the day.
Yeah, because there were so many on the first night, and it was just unbearable. Like, there's, you know, 30 totems. And if you don't know what a totem is, it's just a sign. Yeah. You know, it's what everybody carries around at the festival to say, hey, I'm right here so my group can see me.
Something stupid on a stick. Okay, well, so we got to backtrack a little bit then, because the sign actually came after the the campground situation then.
Oh, did it?
It had to have, because I talked to him the first night.
Okay.
Okay, so apparently there was a lot of hullabaloo on the comments during the live stream about this, about all of the totems, but specifically this jellyfish that was like dead nut center, blocking the view of Derek on the cameras.
Bouncing the whole time.
And me and some of the other crew guys, Whit Hawkins specifically, always try to make it a point to go hang out with the fans anytime there's like a campground scenario or anything like that after the show. So, you know, the whole thing was brought to my attention, and I actually encountered the culprit in the campgrounds very late in the evening. And, you know, we confronted him and asked him politely not to, you know, bring the jellyfish into the venue first off, but if he had to, for whatever reason, please don't go into the middle of the crowd.
Stand off to the side.
Yeah. So first off, he didn't believe that I was who I was. Whit, who is my acting manager in these situations, tried several times to explain to him that he was talking to the laser shark and that he should, you know, respect, you know, what I was telling him, and he wasn't buying it or he wasn't having any of it. So basically, we left it at try us. See what happens tomorrow if you show up with the fucking jellyfish. That was how we left it. And then we walked
away.
So
really, it's your fault for challenging him to do it again.
I mean, I guess so. But, like, you know.
I mean, he was going to do it. Yeah. Let's be honest. You know, he was going to do it again.
Listen.
But you challenged him, he definitely challenged me on purpose.
He challenged me by not believing me or thinking that I would have the balls to actually fucking, you know, prove a point with him. So then you made the sign, which then made it onto the internet. Which then, during our changeover, him and like one or two other totems.
Right in the middle.
Yeah, right in the middle again. So we flashed the sign on the LED wall a couple of times, and I think the other two people got the picture, and they moved off to the side.
There was definitely, he was the straggler.
Yeah,
they did move off to the side because we had Bargy.
Oh, he was
directing traffic.
Yeah,
with a flashlight, pointing at people, going, "Get out of the way!" Yeah. And that guy did not.
Yeah, and so we literally stopped everything. We stopped the house music. turned all the lights on. And I think you and Bargy, right, Neil?
Me and Bargy like, both went downstage and said, move it.
Yeah.
Get it out of here.
And, you know.
And some fans helped us out, too.
Yeah.
They kind of coaxed him over to the side.
And, you know, basically, you know, the moral of the story here is that if you encounter me in the campgrounds at 3 o'clock in the morning and I ask you nicely to do something, you better fucking do it. Because we right. will. We will make an example out of you. Yes. And, and you know, the story spread like wildfire on all the, like, the music blogs. And, you know, everyone was like, yay, somebody finally stood up for the anti-totem movement that has been long coming. And the irony of the whole fucking thing is I'm the one LD that doesn't give a fuck.
Because you see right through them. Like, if you're there in person, you don't see those. You're looking right through it.
There are so many LDs that, get very upset. I won't throw any names out there, but, like, there are so many LDs that take it very, very hard when these totems are blocking their view.
I'm glad I don't have to work with those guys, but at the same time, I am equally as annoyed, you know? Yeah, I hate the prima donnas that are like, oh, yeah, you know, you're fucking with my vibe.
Just like everything.
But at the same time, they're totally right.
Yeah, no, they certainly are. I mean, here's the deal. I want everybody to have an enjoyable experience. It is quite rude to, you know, to think that your little, you know, toy supersedes the enjoyment of the people behind you. Just that, you know, in and of itself is a complete lack of consideration for, you know, all these other people that paid a lot of money to see a show. But on top of that, like, if you think you are so important that all these people need to be able to find you, go somewhere where it's easy to find you.
Nobody's going to get down there in front of house. Nobody's going to make it down there to catch up with you.
I don't know about that.
I mean,
that.
maybe really determined people.
Determined people.
See, I played Glastonbury in 2012, and I just watched the footage of that last week on YouTube. There were no totems in any of the shots there. So it's either a post-2012 thing, but you're talking, Glastonbury is like 150,000 people.
Well, they do the flags.
Yeah, they do flags.
Yes,
but they keep
which
them
is
off
a totem.
Yeah, but they keep them off to the side, I guess.
I don't know if security was dissuading them, because I'm definitely not getting out in a crowd that big.
Maybe. Europeans just, you know,
maybe they're just courteous.
Yeah, they have a little bit more courtesy than us wonderful Americans who can't seem to figure this shit out. But you know, this is one of those occasions where some silly behind the scenes, you know, like it started kind of as like a joke.
Sure.
And it took on a life of its own. And that's one of the great pleasures of getting to do this, because for all of the amazing things that happen during a 2 or 3 hour performance, there is equally as much memorable, you know, nonsense that happens, you know, before and after that performance that only a handful of us get to experience. Yeah. And, you know, it's really what, like, you know, connects you to, you know, the three of us are, you know, amazingly great friends because of all of these, you know, stupid things that we've gotten to do together that, you know, have nothing to do with the concert itself, but, you know, we'll remember those things until, you know, the day we die. And
it's like the chatter on Talkback.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
And you don't listen to it anymore.
Thank God I don't listen to it anymore.
But yeah, some God. Of the most golden moments of my career have been on Talkback mics while the show's been going on.
So to shed a little light on this, years and years and years ago, we developed a system where Derek and myself and whoever the monitor engineer was, we could all kind of communicate with each other during the show. So then that way, like, you know, if anybody had a problem or if somebody had a suggestion, or back in the old days when it was like just me and Derek, or maybe Derek and Adam or something, like when it was just like, you know, when he didn't have all the full band or whatever, you know, sometimes he would get a little lonely up there, And so we would just...
just talk to him.
We would just randomly, you know, interact.
So if you're at a show and you see an artist talking into a microphone, you're like, I can't hear them.
Yeah.
They're probably talking to someone else either on stage or right off stage.
Yeah. But, you know, we we have a knack for, you know, not taking things seriously. And this is another great example of that. Because for me, I had to actually get rid of that part of the experience,
was
I guess.
It was totally distracting to you.
It was a nightmare.
You have too much stuff going on to hear us.
In the beginning, it was when you. It was me and Derek, it was great because, like, well, let me rephrase that. It was usually great. We could kind of, you know, stand. He could tell me what song was coming up, or like he could describe somebody in the front row that I wouldn't be able to see, or whatever the case may be. But then there were times where he would critique what was going on around him, and generally speaking, that would annoy me, and so I would always try to find ways to, you know, to punish him, whether it be blacking out the stage entirely, or being completely inappropriate in some other way with the lights. And that was fun for about 5 minutes, and then I realized, I was like, okay, there's 10,000 people watching us. I probably shouldn't be doing this. But then, as the crew got bigger and as the band got bigger, this communication system became extremely overwhelming for me. So I made the choice to separate myself from all of that. But during the changeovers leading up to the show, I would usually have my ears in.
For the most part.
At least for like 10 or 15 minutes, and I would chime in. But like all of you guys, I'll let you guys kind of, you know, give some great examples of the nonsense that would happen, either setting up the show or even during the show, because I honestly have no idea.
The most memorable one to me, I believe, was, I think it was first night of Red Rocks 2018, when the band did, I can't remember what song they were playing, but they were doing the Circle of Fifths. And if you know anything about music, it's kind of like a DJ thing and a musician thing, that you can transition, it's different chord progressions go together around in a big circle. There's a chart for it. Just Google it, Circle of Fifths. And I don't remember if it was Derek or Carnes or Borum, but somebody said, let's do the Circle of Fifths. And nobody will know what's going on, but this is going to be great. And they talked about it the entire time. It took 10 minutes of a jam that went all the way around at least once. But it was so entertaining that, like, to hear that side of things, that's like one of the only stories you can actually tell.
Yeah, we were the only people that knew it, and it was awesome.
But it was super entertaining. Transition. It's like, yes.
Yeah, it was very entertaining. A lot of shows have been entertaining throughout the years. They're talk back. Derek, he's you never know what he's going to send you.
No.
Derek. You got to be on your toes. That's for sure.
I really hope that Witt records that stuff, but hopefully he holds on to it in like the best safe in the world.
I can't imagine.
Because some of it is rather incriminating, at least embarrassing to some folks.
Yeah.
But there's some golden moments there that like should come out in the DVD extras, you know?
Yeah,
exactly.
That DVD that'll come out in 2060 or so.
Soon.
Soon, yeah, exactly.
Soon.
40 years from now. So, Neil, as the stage manager, you're probably the most in tune with all of that, because you have to babysit everything that is going on around you.
That's it. I never know what they're going to ask for or what they're going to need. Definitely, you know.
How has your enjoyment of the show changed since you took on the stage manager role? Because when you first started working for us, you were just my laser tech.
Yeah.
And
I got brought in on the laser towers.
Yeah, the laser diamonds.
Yeah.
Yeah. God, what a... what a great idea, just poorly timed that was. But like, as the stage manager now, like, because there's so much going on around you, I mean, has it affected your enjoyment of the show?
Oh yeah, I love it. I mean, it's brought it to a whole nother level for me, because instead of just doing one portion of it, I'm involved from the morning, from the time I arrive to the time those trucks are closed. I'm on it all day. It's I love it. I love my job.
Pretty Lights. This is why this guy right here is irreplaceable.
Yeah, absolutely the most hardworking guy on a stage I've ever seen. Well, a lot of people talk about
Formula
1 drivers.
It's not work if you love it. It's not work if you love it.
That's true.
It's not. I don't look at it as work.
So, okay. So what is one of your most memorable experiences?
Most memorable experiences. Rolling the orchestra out from behind a video wall, right up behind Derek and the band. And they're just pure music, man. It was probably the highlight of my life, rolling that orchestra out there.
I mean, that was definitely an incredible evening.
That's one of the top two shows that we've ever put on. Probably the last Red Rock show was probably the best show. Yeah. Everything was clicking that night.
Those were my first Red Rock shows too.
Oh, really?
The orchestra?
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Like
first rolling into it, two
first
sold
Red Rock
shows.
Ever?
Yeah.
Or just with us?
No, working.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah, that was a good one.
That shit was overwhelming, to say the least.
It tends to always be overwhelming at Red Rocks.
And let's not forget what we did on that last Red Rock show.
Yeah, let's talk about that for a little
bit. Let's not forget, because I don't think there's anybody else in this. I can't say anybody else, but I don't know of any other crew or any other people that could have pulled that off.
What Neil is alluding to is... It's hard to really like describe exactly how all of this kind of came together, but we all knew going into the last set of Red Rock shows that we were going to be taking a break afterwards, and there was a decision made based on my idiotic confidence in myself to forego any sort of production rehearsal.
Oh yeah. I forgot how lunacy.
That, didn't you?
To save a little bit of money, because we knew that we weren't going to be playing shows for a while. And so management and myself had the conversation of, can we pull this off without spending a buttload of money to rehearse all of this?
And to give the backstory, when we've done Red Rocks before, we've done like a week in another building leading up to it, just getting it all fine-tuned and getting it right, not just rolling in hot.
Yep. So for these shows, it was the first time that I programmed the entire show essentially, on my own, since it became the advanced entity that it is. Like in the early days, I programmed everything by myself. But like when we really started getting into the more like complex and like crazy programming and stage designs, I've had video guys, and I've had Gabe, help me with programming and all that stuff. And this show, I did all of the programming on my own, and I had Eric Mincer, he created Crescent Sun, which is the media server that we use. Like he was there, he was programming the media server portions, just building the things that I needed, but like none of the actual playback. So that's why I say I did it on my own. But I do want to give him credit for facilitating. So did this whole show on my own and with no rehearsal and no planned programming. So the entire show, top to bottom, was improvised. And the first time that I saw the rig turn on was the second the show started, which...
With 12,000 people watching.
Yeah.
Is that place called 12?
10,000.
10,000.
But looking back on it, it was completely ridiculous that we even attempted to do that. And then to top that, the fact that it succeeded in such a way that it could never be replicated. Something about, obviously, knowing, going into the shows, knowing that we were going to be taking an extended break, I think helped facilitate, a certain, spark to just go for it in the way that we did. But to build a show of that scope and never see it turn on until the show actually starts.
I think that says a lot about how the confidence that you have in all the people around you.
Hopefully I'll never have to do that again, but I definitely relish in the fact that it worked as well as it did, given all those circumstances.
It was definitely the most organic show.
That
I've ever done.
The entire thing is completely just, it's just made up on the spot. And, going back to the whole, me separating from the communication system, Derek and the band are, talking about and, helping each other, move from, section to section. And I am completely separate from any of that. So all I am doing is listening and reacting and creating in the moment. And it's something that I don't think, like you kind of said, there aren't many people that can do it. And I think there's a lot to be said for accepting all of the imperfections, because if you look back and you watch it, there's a lot of stupid shit that happened.
It's like jazz.
Yeah. That's a great way to put it.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
But there's, so many designers are seeking this perfection, whether it's a time-coded show or whether it's a, choreographed or this thing or that thing or whatever, and to completely forego all of that for the sake of the moment is something unholy special to me. And to you guys, I think, too, because, we all kind of talked about it afterwards, how very intensely, special it was.
Yeah.
Most of the big shows that you see that a lot of people don't know is, there's weeks, if not months, of pre-production involved where the band's in a venue that's closed off to everybody else. Nobody sees it. They spend days, if not weeks, taping cables together, because there's hundreds of miles of cable.
And
at just about any show you go see,
They play the same song. They're in the same position. The bands themselves.
Right.
So it's totally improv, and we don't even know what's coming next.
And with Red Rocks especially, there's three off days in a season at Red Rocks. So you don't get the luxury of a lot of times. You can go into a venue the day before, set it up and tweak it, and have a day to chill. But this, you go into Red Rocks at 4 or 5 o'clock in the morning. And that's when you start, and you end at sunrise the next day. I've done one show in my life at Red Rocks that hasn't ended would be watching the sunrise as I drive away in the van.
Yeah. That's so true.
It's a lot to manage. It's a lot to accept the responsibility that comes with that. You were starting to say, for you guys, to not be able to properly prepare the rig and then to still be able to get it up, get it right in that short amount of time. We as a group have a unique ability to rise to the occasion, and that goes for everybody. And it goes way beyond the shows. It goes to the attitudes. It goes to the effort. It goes to the mentality, of everybody that's involved.
Their mental approach to it, yeah.
Yeah, and that's something that, we've all been in this business 20-plus years now. And I think we can all recognize that somehow, some way, we all came together to create, this, very unique team that can't be duplicated in so many ways.
I agree 100%. But I think it's it starts with Derek too,
Yeah. Absolutely.
He's the same way.
He's
just like us.
His his ability to challenge all of us, I think, is definitely one of the things
we love that it
forces us to rise to the occasion.
Yeah,
even on a very quiet day, he can make it loud.
It's definitely not for the faint of heart.
Yeah. You also have to be a glutton for punishment.
That's why we all got into this, right?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I guess so. I didn't know that going
to be
into
challenged
it.
To, you know.
Yeah,
I didn't know it either, but yeah, it ends up like being one of those things like, I'm going to tell this story later on and just bitch about it. But I was having the time of my life, you know?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I'll never know what it's like to be a musician on stage with the crowd cheering, but I feel that when I get to watch that happen and it's say, you know, I had a huge part of that.
Yeah. That's the thing. Like, we all, like, when the crowd's cheering, you know, they're cheering for all of us. And they, especially, like, you know, our fans,
yeah,
the Pretty
Lights
fans.
They
understand all that goes into it, and they understand that there's so much more than just the five people on stage. You know, there are nights where they chant my name. There have been nights when they chant fucking Witt's name. Like, you get so much love on the internet, Smokey, you know, for the streams.
I am internet famous.
You are
because of the streams.
Yeah, absolutely. And so you know, that's one of the cool things too, where it's like our fan base has acknowledged well past just the people that they see in front of them. And that, I think, a trip, you know, that goes to the point of like what all of us as a team do together really stands out. Because if the fans can notice and acknowledge the crew guys, you're doing something right.
Absolutely.
You know, like,
and I've got to say, I've worked with a lot of bands. I've done a lot of touring, and as far as a crew goes, the Pretty Lights crew is above and beyond the best that I've ever worked with. Like, it's more of a family thing than it is coworkers.
Yeah,
and
absolutely.
You know, you're living on a bus or whatever with 20 other people. You get at each other's throats. Yeah. Like, there's no doubt that I have cussed you out and you've cussed me out. But
I don't
5 minutes
ever,
later,
I don't think I've ever cussed you out, Smokey.
Yes,
maybe once. Actually,
Camp Bisco. One of the very few show failures that I've ever had.
Yep.
It all went to shit at the first note.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And, yeah, you were livid, but...
He was livid. He wasn't livid at you. He was just livid.
Yeah, he was just livid.
I'm so happy that I don't remember these things.
It had to do with... I don't remember. It was... We were adapting to the festival set.
Yeah.
And there was some scaling involved.
Scaling,
everything was too
big,
so we had to scale it down a little bit. And I had a piece of gear fail. And I always have a backup for everything. Mm-hmm. But this one thing, I did not have a backup for. And it failed at the worst possible time. Like, right at the beginning of the show, it just took a shit.
Really?
I ran from backstage out to front of house. And they'd cut off the aisle that went to front of house. Like, you know, 150 feet wide all the way to front of house. Like, they had barricades there. They had security there. And I stiff-armed a security guy, knocked him down like a linebacker. I've never performed like that in my entire life, but he was like, no, 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 you can't go. And I was like, dunk, and just knocked him right out of the way and got right to front of house and fixed it. And it was 90 seconds of my life, but it's like the worst show failure I've ever had. Well, but we recovered, and it was a great show, and, you know, nobody knew. Nobody knew.
I mean,
thank God for the laser shark.
Absolutely.
I love hearing these stories because I honestly do not fucking remember them. And I don't know if that goes to, like, I think that's part of the charm of the approach, I guess. Because, like, I talk to Phil all the time. You know, everybody knows who Phil Salvaggio is. And he will bring up all sorts of different scenarios. And I'm just like, I have no idea what the fuck you're talking about. And he's like, how do you not remember this stuff? And I'm like, because if I did, I would be the most depressed person on the planet, because all I would do is, like, eat me alive. And so I think part of, like, being able to put all of the good things and all of the bad things behind you and just keep moving forward is the only way that I've been able to maintain my sanity after all these years. And so, like, things like this, like, honestly, dude, I couldn't even tell you. Was this at Montage?
Yeah.
Yes. You were definitely screaming.
I mean, I'm sure
it's one
I
of those things, like, most of the time when I go to a concert that's not one that I'm working,
yeah,
I'm hypercritical about everything on stage. I see, like, the group of pixels that are out on an LED panel for Nine Inch Nails or whatever that nobody else sees.
Or, like, 30 Seconds to Mars.
There's that. That was a good one. But nobody really sees it because they're not critiquing it like we are professionals that do that. So, like, 99% of your audience
doesn't
have any clue what's going on, that there's something wrong.
Yep.
Oh, my God. I wish there's a part of me that really wishes I could, like, recall this memory so I could, like, channel that anger right now. Just so I could.
I'm kind of surprised you don't remember.
I honestly have no.
But I know you let it just go. Yeah, so you let it roll off your.
You're definitely. You weren't on ears, so I couldn't talk. I was trying to talk back to you and, like, thinking, well, he's not going to hear me.
Yeah.
But I'm yelling. I'm fixing it. I'm working on it. Just leave me alone. Lumpy walks over to me and says, "Hey, what can I do?" And I was like, "Just get the fuck out of my way. I'm dealing with this. What's going on? Tell me what the problem is." Like, I'm in a zone here. You have to leave me alone. And then I got out to front of house, and you probably weren't really mad, but I was really mad at myself. And whatever you said, I was like, oh, he's totally
pissed at you.
I've let him down.
Yeah.
And then I had it fixed. But like I said, it's 90 seconds, top of the show. Nobody knew what was going on. But those are the things that I see of myself. I'm like, oh, I've had a failure.
Yeah.
This never happens.
So there's one thing that I've always tried to explain this to people, and for people that aren't in the industry or aren't in any sort of, like, ultra pressurized environment, if you talk loudly at somebody, you aren't yelling at them. When you're in the heat of the moment, like, I'm sure
I do that a lot.
Yeah, we all do.
We're in our zone. We're
and so, like, there is a certain what's the word I'm looking for here? There's a certain, like, ferocity to what you're saying, right? But the intention isn't necessarily, like, anger, right? It's just intensity.
Urgency.
Yeah, urgency, intensity, right? And so, like, I used to, back in the, like, olden days, right? Before you guys were around. Because here's the deal. You guys helped me in ways where it's like, because I have so much confidence in you, even with your singular failure, I suppose, I have so much confidence in you guys that I don't have that, like, built-up anxiety before the show like I used to have. And so, like, there would be times where, like, I would say something aggressively, but it wasn't in a way to be, like, you know, nasty. It was just, like, the passion of it all just comes out, right?
Yeah.
And so there's a difference sometimes between, like, yelling at somebody and very bigly talking to somebody. You know what I mean? Because, like, if you see it from, like, the outside looking in, it's like, how the fuck do these people work together? They're screaming at each other.
Right. They must hate each other.
Yeah, but that's not the case whatsoever.
That's not at all the case.
Yeah. And it's just like the heat of the moment, and, like, once it's said, and you move on with your day, and you never think about it again. And there are no hurt feelings. There shouldn't be any hurt feelings, or there shouldn't be any, like, resentment. You know,
very rarely.
It happens, unfortunately, because there are misunderstandings. But, like, when you're in this kind of environment, it's very, very hard to contain all of the things that are going on inside of you.
And or say something civilly.
Yeah.
When you're just, like, you just want to get it out.
Yeah.
Communicate it. Yeah. Make sure the point is taken.
And so,
and then that's it.
See, Greg's got the upper hand here, because he yells at us, but we can yell back at him, but he doesn't hear it. We're like, motherfucker, we're on it.
Even if you're standing right next to me and you're yelling at me, I don't hear it.
I know, but it's like, imagine someone yell at you about, what's going on? And you're trying to tell them, but they can't hear you. So it's like...
I mean, that used to happen with you a lot.
Yeah.
Because I'd be like, Neil, fix the goddamn fog machines or whatever. And, like, da-da-da, and whatever. It, well, you know, here's the thing, though, right?
We have to go through Phil.
Yeah, somebody, right? Like, usually, usually there's somebody around me that does have the ears in. And so they can relay whatever they're saying to me. But if they're not paying attention and I go, Neil, fix the fucking fog machines, and 30 seconds go by and I don't get the tap on the shoulder or I don't necessarily see you, then I go, God fucking damn it, Neil, fix the fucking fog machines. And then he goes, I'm fucking fixing them. Leave me the fuck alone. And, you know, this is, you know, this is on me because I had to separate them myself. But like, he has never once after the show, except for maybe one time, been like, you were a complete asshole. Like, he understands.
Yeah.
You know?
But that was probably over beers.
It's gotten a lot
and better. A hug.
A lot better or a lot worse?
A lot better.
Yeah. Oh, dude.
Since day one.
Yeah. I mean, I was a mess in the early days. But that's, you know, that's all part of the experience. Yeah. You got to go through the rock and roll phase to get to the grizzled veteran phase.
Yeah.
So, Neil, let's talk about the waterfall.
Oh, the waterfall. Ooh. 2018?
Get on that microphone.
No, that was...
17? New Orleans?
16.
No, it wasn't 16. It was 17. Right?
New Orleans.
I have no idea.
Because 18 was the last Red Rock show, and there wasn't a New 17. Year's prior to that. So it was... Oh, it was 2017 then.
Well, no, 17... 17 was
16 into 17.
17 was Philly. Yeah. So yeah.
16. Oh, so it was 15 then.
16 into 17.
Oh wow! I didn't realize it was that long.
The last New Year's was New Orleans.
No, Philly.
Philly.
That's 17 That's right. into 18.
More. Yeah, the water screen, man.
Yeah, I mean, well, you were the.
It was exactly what we needed. You know,
you were the reason it happened. So tell everybody. How it all came to be.
Well, it was so easy to set up.
Oh, yeah, it's nothing. I do it in my sleep. Yeah, the water screen, I just thought it would add a more, you know, another layer to our show, the depth. I thought what we were doing at the time, it just kind of fit with the, you know, abstract designs and, you know, your vision, and you know how to use them. You know, a lot of people don't know how to use special effects. They just, like, overuse them or not use them enough, but you use, you know.
Well, that's everything. I mean, that was the thing, like, for years that killed me about the idea of projections.
Yeah.
For me, if you have a projection screen on stage, it hinders
the rest of the show.
But this water screen that Neil showed me, you could turn it on and you could turn it off, and so it could be there when I wanted it and it could disappear when I didn't.
Exactly.
And so the great story behind the actual waterfall situation was Neil and I had plotted this thing for months before the show and didn't tell anybody. Phil was the only person who knew about it before we got to New Orleans.
Yep.
Derek had no idea.
The band, nobody
knew. Nobody knew about it. So it was like my Christmas present to Derek. I was like, I've got a surprise for you. You're going to love it. And we kept it from him. And so the first time he saw it turn on was during soundcheck leading up to the first show. And there's a little funny sidebar to that whole thing. So that same New Year's, Fish at MSG, their gag was for the song Petrichor. And there's a section where the rain came down or whatever. And so they also made it rain the same night that we did.
Yep.
Except they used plastic little, like, pellets.
Yeah. But it was on the audience too, right?
Yeah. And yeah, well, I think it was like on the stage and like maybe around the audience a little bit. But like, yeah, I just, for some reason, that's one of those things that's like stuck in my head, because for whatever crazy, weird, like, you know, happenstance, my favorite band, on the same night as us, we made it rain simultaneously. And I've always loved that idea.
They were smart about it and used pellets.
Well, yeah, it was a completely different.
No, you know, totally. But yeah. You know, if there's one good thing to do around millions of dollars worth of light, sound, and video equipment, is pour a bunch of water around it.
Yeah. Well, fortunately, I don't think we broke anything, did we?
I don't think we did. It made a mess.
Yeah,
there was water everywhere. But
yeah, the kids
loved
it. I don't
think we broke anything.
I definitely saw some pictures of the kids like in the front row, and they were just like trying to get like their heads in it and shit. Sure.
Oh, they were reaching for it. And then Derek brought that champagne down.
Oh yeah.
Down in the pit, and looked like he was about ready to fall into the water, and then the kid got the champagne bottle and he didn't fall, but it was so close. Can you imagine Derek falling in the pit of the water? The water pit.
Oh my gosh.
I think the best part of that night, though, was hearing that we're not going to get stagehands for the outs. We're just going to do it the next day. And I think that was either during the show or right before it. We were planning on loading out that night right afterwards. Yeah. And they gave us the news, the stagehands aren't going to show up, so we're just going to go sleep it off and then come back the next day. It was sweet. So we actually get to enjoy it a little bit.
Have we ever actually loaded out on New Year's?
Philly.
Did we?
Philly for sure.
I feel like you usually load out the next day.
Yeah, like San Francisco, we loaded out the next day.
San Francisco, we had a full day off because they didn't work on the first, so we get to do it on the second.
Yeah, you know, the labor bill's pretty high if you want to load out on New Year's Eve. But I thought, was Philly, I thought we did New Year's Eve and then a second night. Didn't we do a second night?
Yeah, it was Philly. What was the night before?
It was Detroit and then
Detroit
Philly.
And then Philly, yeah.
Oh, that Detroit show.
Snowing.
It was like 3 degrees outside and snowing during loadout. And I think we were taking turns telling them how to load the truck. Like, you go in there now, and everybody else is going to warm up inside, but you go out there and just point into the truck. Put it in there. Just get rid of it.
Oh, my gosh. So, all right. So what was your first show, Smokey?
Snowball 2013.
Oh, that was with the stupid video spheres?
Yeah, that was the first. So that's how I got into the Pretty Lights campus. They wanted these globes, these spheres of LED.
Yeah, the LED balls, yeah.
Somebody else was doing the other stuff, and
Dave,
I came in
Dave,
with the spheres.
Well, no, so I think we were still getting video from maybe Brown Note or something like that. But like, yeah, we had you guys bring in the video spheres.
And I literally brought in 3 fixtures.
Yeah.
And that was all my gig
I remember,
was. It
you
was
came up to
so
me and you were
grand.
Like, this is the easiest fucking show I've ever done in my life. Meanwhile.
Sounds like a good gig.
I wanted to fucking smash my head into the fucking wall because it was one of the most frustrating shows I've ever had to deal with. And I couldn't even tell you why. I just remember hating every second of it.
And then the second show I did was just with spheres also. And I think we went up to 5. It was the San Francisco New Year's show.
Yeah.
And somebody, again, another vendor was doing all the rest of the panels.
Was that weird festival thing?
Yeah, that festival at the Billy Graham.
Yeah, Billy Graham.
But
the other, whatever other company it was, didn't bring enough processors.
DSI, I thought it was DSI.
Yeah, I wasn't going to call them out.
What, for San
Well, they don't
Fran?
Exist anymore. Okay. Yeah, it was them, San Francisco. Okay. So they brought all the panels.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
They were like 2 processors short of being able to make it all work. And I was like, hey, I've got a work box and I've got 2 of them in the fucking box. And then the rest, like every Pretty Light show since then, I've done LED for.
Yep.
All of it.
You are essential. If they are.
I'm an essential worker.
You are an essential worker. Oh my gosh. And so, Neil, what was your first show?
My first show was, I think it was Coachella when we did the Laser Towers because we did rehearsal.
That's right, yeah. So we did rehearsal in Vegas.
Mm-hmm. Then went and did Coachella. Yeah. I got hired as the Laser Tower Laser Tech.
Yeah.
And the rest is history.
The rest is history. That was, oh my gosh. So was that, I'm trying to think, oh, that's right. Okay, so we were like one of the first like electronic acts to play on the second stage, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And was that one?
I don't think that was the Wu-Tang year. I think that was the second year. I think Wu-Tang. Was that Wu-Tang that year? Can't quite remember if it was that year or the
I
next
can't
year.
No, I think.
Yeah, because all the electronic acts always played the Sahara Tent.
Yeah.
You know, and
was that the one where the console crashed? And like I lost like a bunch of shit.
You were in the Kansas at that time, so it might have been.
Yeah, because I had to.
All I know is we rocked that place. Yeah. I mean, as far as you could see, I mean, everybody was just jamming.
Gosh,
it was a good show.
That's one of the best feelings of doing those huge, massive festivals, and just having a good night.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, you're on such a high leaving that.
Dude, I can't even remember, like, what the stage looked like. The only thing I can remember is, like, the Laser Diamonds, and then that was, we had that weird DJ booth, right? With the little
magic panels, right? Was that the magic panel?
Was that?
I believe that was the magic panels. Yeah.
Oh wow! Jeez. Yeah. See, there you go.
How many universes was it?
Too many. Too goddamn many. It's just crazy to me because, like, we've done so much in such a pretty short period of time when you really think about it. I mean, essentially 10 years, a little under that. And most bands, they tour the same rig for 2 or 3 years.
Oh, that'd be so nice.
Yeah, yeah. Wouldn't that be nice?
And I mean, we've gone through fucking 12, 15 overhauls over the span of 10 years.
Sometimes five
but
or six
at the
just
same
in the
time,
tour.
I mean, yeah. Once again, that just, you know, goes to the inspiration,
yeah.
You know, not wanting to do the same thing, wanting to create something different for the fans, you know.
One of the things I love to hate about you is it's ingenuitive, but it's always like night after night, we do 5 shows in a week. And not a single one of them is set up the same way or plugged in the same way. It's like you always want to change something, which is fantastic.
Or ran the same way.
And I love it, but at the same time, a lot of tours go out and do exactly the same thing all the time. And you know, you're off the bus at 8 o'clock in the morning, you're back on the bus at, you know, noon, you get to nap. Not with Pretty Lights, because it always changes just a little bit. Or you throw in like an underplay at a tiny club somewhere.
Yeah.
Or you take a whole arena's worth of stuff and shove it into a 500 capacity club.
So there we go. Okay, this is a great one. And I do actually remember this one. The Hive.
Oh, yeah. The Hive and Sandpoint.
So this is one of those magical underplays that. I don't even know how the hell this show happened. It's completely beyond me. But we were in the middle of like a West Coast run, and we go and we do this show in, what is it, like 450 people?
At the most,
it was definitely around 5. Like Pink
Carter.
I wasn't
so
was
worried
Pink
about
Carter
the crowd.
Smaller?
I was just more worried about the band on stage.
The stage was like 20 feet wide and 10 feet deep.
Yeah.
And we crammed 5 people onto it.
And,
you know, if anything would have broke on stage backline, we couldn't have got on there.
No.
It was insane. But those are one of those shows that remind you of how good you have it, you know, because there are so many challenges to make it work in such a small environment. But what those things do.
That show almost didn't happen.
It definitely did. I don't know if I want to go into all that,
okay.
But. Because,
The show was going to happen, but...
Let's just put it this way. Yeah. Me and the owner had some fun with each other during the day. And him and I were not seeing eye to eye. And he threatened to cancel the show, and I told him to go right ahead.
The show happened.
The show ended up happening. But, we definitely got into it. And
once again.
Yeah. But in the midst of all of that, Neil had the bright idea to create a laser ceiling with our, what we would usually use for the laser cage. And he mounted a bunch of these laser bars over the audience. And it was a once in a lifetime thing because normally you would never have the opportunity to do something like that. And while I'm having a pissing match with the owner, Neil's over there fucking coming up with one of the coolest things we've ever done. And, you know, and it's so funny to me because while there was this grand misunderstanding, we can compartmentalize all these different things and be like, okay, well, Greg's over there fighting with the owner. Phil's, you know, over there doing nothing. You know,
he's sending emails, man.
Yeah, these guys are over here trying to put, you know, 8 million instruments on a stage that shouldn't hold 10. And then Neil's like, I'm going to fucking hang a bunch of lasers over the audience. Let's do this. And I was just like, why are we going out of our way to do this when this fucking guy is being such a prick? And Neil's like, it's not about him. It's about the kids that are coming to the show. And I was like, you know what? You're absolutely right. Go fucking go for it.
Go have it.
Let me know when it's ready. And, you know, we'll make it happen. And so we tested it during soundcheck. And I was just like, holy fuck. This is going to be
crush.
Overwhelming. And then there were so many people in that fucking building. Like, oversold.
Definitely over capacity.
Yeah, oversold is an understatement. But the best part of the whole thing was Taylor Hicks just happened to be there.
Yeah.
American Idol Taylor Hicks. He's friends with some people that we're friends with. And where I was set up was like right in the belly of the beast. And there wasn't much security. And it got hectic. And Taylor is literally tossing kids around that are almost like crash landing on my console. And like, I couldn't think of a more surreal day where it went from, you know, the show almost getting canceled, I guess, to Taylor Hicks being my personal security guard. And then, you know, all the meanwhile, like, we're doing something unholy unique with the light show that, you know, like I said, we can never replicate unless we went back there, I guess. And like, that's it's crazy.
It was set up perfect for it, though.
So
Taylor is from Birmingham. So he's from my hometown, and I knew him far, far before the whole American Idol thing. And I was walking through, I think it was about an hour before we went on, and I was walking through backstage, and I like walked right past him, and I like, there's something weird. And then he goes, Smokey? I was you don't really recognize people when you see him out of element like that. Sure. Like, why is Taylor Hicks going to be at fucking Sandpoint, Idaho?
Yeah.
And he like recognized me. He's like, Smokey? I'm like, why are you here? So I know the owner, blah, 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 blah. Oh, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
So I didn't recognize the winner of American Idol. He recognized me. So maybe legendary.
Legendary.
I'll take that.
Yeah. See, there you go.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh,
that was a good run.
I'm trying to think of other. Oh, here's a good one. Again, this one goes to Neil. The Gorge.
Ah, the Gorge, the Valley.
Yeah. So, you know, I get a lot of credit for, you know, all the shenanigans that we do, but you know, oftentimes it's other people's ideas that really stand out, and I'm 100% open to, you know, if somebody has a good idea, please fucking, you know, tell me, because I'm, as much as I'm a creative person and as much as I'm constantly trying to like one up myself, there are so many times where I'm going to miss the obvious awesome thing. And the Gorge is a great example of that.
Neil's idea was to set wildfires in British Columbia and have all the smoke pour down.
Well, that was a whole other thing. That was actually another time where the show almost got canceled.
Yeah, I remember.
They were considering shutting it down because of the air quality. But Neil was like, we're fucking hanging these Lixels on the back of the stage and we're going to shoot them over the canyon. And all the while, a cardboard cutout of John Cena made sure that nothing stupid happened. But, you know, so basically we mounted a bunch of these lasers over the back of the stage, shot them over the canyon. If you've ever been to the Gorge, it's the campgrounds are a fair walk away. And you walk through this little valley onto the backside, and so we set up these lasers so that way while everyone was walking back to their campgrounds, they had something fun to look at. And one of the coolest things that I've ever experienced, because you know I've been going to the Gorge for a long time and it's a legendary venue and not a lot of acts get to play there, but you know the second day, two of the staff members that have been working there for 30 plus years were like, I just want you guys to know, this is the coolest shit that anybody's ever done here. So kudos. And like, when you hear that kind of stuff, that's like, it really like it stands out and it really means something, because like as much like love and adoration and this thing and that thing that you get from whether it's the fans or other people in the industry. But when you go to a place like that, that is, has so much history, but also is so exclusive, and to have people that like understand all of that and have been there for all of it, for them to like go out of their way to say that, I was just like, holy shit. All right.
Especially that venue, because it's one of the most hostile venues you can do a show at. It's a like commitment. 3 hours outside of Seattle. It's 30 minutes to the closest gas station. And it's just, it's hard to live out in that environment. And people that do those shows all the time are generally pretty curmudgeon-y and very, you know, jaded about it. And they're like, just get your show done and get the fuck out. But when they speak up and say, you know, that was really a special event, that's, you know, that's a big pat on the back for sure.
Absolutely.
I was there 2 weeks before that show doing a festival, and it was like hell on earth.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, we got the same compliment at the New Hampshire show. The owners of that place said an amazing show, and they were like, they were just like, because they don't really do a lot of camping there, but they allowed us to camp, and their property was cleaner than it was when we arrived, and they were just so thankful.
Yeah, Telluride, I mean, you know, so here's a little, you know,
Telluride insider
thing, I guess. You know, the original plan was like, we're going to do Telluride, and it's going to be a one-and-done situation. They were very, very adamant about, like, never bringing somebody back 2 years in a row. And for all of the great things that we do, it was the fans, you guys, that really impressed the town. They could not believe how respectful, how, you know, how much care you put into you know, cleaning up after yourselves, into taking care of the properties, you know, not causing trouble, not creating any kind of scenes. And it was you guys that enabled us to go back for a second year. So thank you for that, because, you know, we do cool shows, but the town doesn't give a fuck about that. It's you guys, you know, that made that happen. And so be proud of that, because that says a lot about you guys. And I think, you know, with that being said, I got to... Let's see here. All right. So every week I pick a obscure movie out of my extensive VHS collection. And these movies are...
Have you ever seen his VHS collection?
I have.
These movies are selected very, you know, specifically for, you know, for the guests. And this week's selection is a very, very, very special one. If you've ever seen The Room, the, you know, the movie that the James Franco kind of depicted or whatever, right? It's this cult classic, complete, you know, piece of trash movie. This is the Canadian version of that.
Oh, great.
And it's titled Rock and Roll Nightmare. And it may be the greatest movie ever made.
That's bold.
And I don't mean that in any way other than, like, it might be the worst movie ever made, which makes it the greatest movie ever made. But so a little bit of, like, the, you know, the back description here. A hot new rock group, their sexy young girlfriends, an out-of-the-way farm. It should have been the week of their dreams. Instead, it became a rock and roll nightmare. Because after a day of making music and making love... This band is starting to break up one by one, limb by limb. Rock and Roll Nightmare features sensational new music by Thor and dozens of horrifying special effects created by a small army of visual and makeup artists. Rock and Roll Nightmare. When the band starts to rock, heads start to roll. This, yes. Okay, so basically Thor is the Canadian version of that guy that James Franco plays in that, okay, in that movie, right? It's very much like in the same vein. It was like self-produced. It's this crazy, crazy, just like, it might as well be like a home movie, right? But it has so much flair and so much ambition that it is just the greatest train wreck you could possibly witness.
Where do you find the time to dig up these gems?
Dude, it's a whole thing. You know, I don't sleep much, let's put it that way. but in a very special way, I feel like it relates to what we do as Pretty Lights and as all of us. We are not polished. We are not the most professional, but we fucking try harder than everybody else. We love what we do more than everybody else. And that's where magic is created. And just in the same way as this movie, if you ever get the opportunity to watch this, you will see the most unbelievable just nonsense, but you cannot stop watching it. And I can't wait for the time when we can start doing our version of Rock and Roll Nightmare, because it will happen again one day. When that day comes, who the fuck knows? But until then, I want to thank you, Neil.
Thank you.
I want to thank you, Smokey.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's been fun.
How great is it that you guys are both in Atlanta at the same time? Who would have thunk it? And until next time, this has been Bioluminescence. Thank you.